Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, where...
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stacy Olkowski. And sitting next to my feminist co-host here, who's just shocked me.
Oh, he just called me Mrs. Crawford.
I'm old.
Okay.
When you're married and you have the same name as a man you're married to.
His name's Rose.
I know.
Okay, never mind.
I know. I accept that you don't always use the same name.
Shall we start again? Let's start again.
No, I think it's our audience should know who they're listening to.
Behind this, but they don't know who they're listening to if they think they're listening to Mrs. Crawford. Okay, we'll move on.
Hello, this is Stas Ziolkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
We are your co-hosts at enlightenradio.org.
Broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia.
And this is the Storytelling Hour.
And today is Monday, February 10th, 2020. I'm still not used to saying 2020. That seems just an amazing date to me. Our theme today is more romance.
Yes.
Is that our theme? Okay.
Yeah.
We're in agreement this time. Okay. We have stories for you. We have calendar information for you.
Yes.
And who knows what else?
Who knows what
we
else?
Don't know what we have for you. Okay.
Thank you to Andy Offit-Irwin for that wonderful opening. Andy allows us to use his beautiful song, Tarry Here, an invitation to sit down on the porch and listen to a story.
It's true.
It's wonderful. I'm so jealous I didn't write it.
Well, it's been a long week, and we're actually pre-recording this session, so we're not going to be able to talk with authority about the weekend, but... A lot has happened this week, in my life anyway. I had jury duty for part of the week, and that was exciting. Mm. What else? I had a big Valentine's celebration with one of my organizations, and so I'm in Valentine mode.
Yeah.
Haven't eaten any chocolate yet, but that'll come, okay. No doubt.
I'll be in Valentine mode next Friday when it's Valentine's Day because that's the day I'm going to get a massage.
How romantic.
Healthy.
Okay. I don't see a timer going. Do we know what time it is?
Well, the reason is I had it hidden. I thought we could just fly by the seat of our pants on this week, but it's...
Yeah, right.
Okay. So,
for a whole hour?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we can go for 54 minutes.
Okay, if you say so.
Oh, I was counting.
All right. do you have any weekly updates, or shall we go right into a story? Or do you want to talk about, you want to talk about calendar.
Oh.
Actually, yeah, I shouldn't tell you something. What you want to talk about.
You never know. It's okay.
This has been quite a morning so far.
Yeah, we've had...
We never should have talked politics in the car. I'm completely disoriented.
I don't think we talked politics at all. We were talking human nature.
Okay, well...
Which is different.
Yes, no doubt.
I think it's
different.
Anyway,
okay.
We were talking about individual people and why they don't do what
what's
we
wrong
want
with them.
To do. Okay, so, but here's an announcement, everyone. Last Saturday on February the 8th.
You mean if today were the real day? Okay.
Right. So we're pre-recording this show. So tomorrow, which is February the 8th, at the Hagerstown Library, the library of Washington County, and it's the main library. We are going to do a performance of stories, similar to what we're doing now, romance stories.
Except much better organized.
Who knows?
Well, that's true.
Yeah. And I'm excited about that because this will be our second time as a guild to perform there.
The Antietam Storytelling Guild.
And we did a good job last time, I think.
Organized by Mark Brew himself.
Right. And I'm going to get to be the MC again. I'm not sure why Mark doesn't want to be the MC, but maybe...
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And you do it really, really well. Yeah. Not that Mark doesn't do it well. No, he does also, I mean, but this way he gets to focus on stories.
That's right. So anyway, I do like doing it. I like introducing people, and I like being able to say nice things about people. So, and besides, if I'm the MC, then it's not strange to be at the microphone.
You're already
immersed. It's like being in the
broken
water.
Broken in.
It's like being in the pool already before the race.
Okay.
So, that's tomorrow at 2 o'clock. It was tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And, wow. The studio looks really neat and interesting.
Yeah, there's more pictures hung up.
There's a picture of Rosie's Diner right in front of us.
John Case's son has been busy organizing.
And the second car from the left...
On Rosie's Diner picture?
Oh, yes.
By Lucinda Lewis, Roadside America?
That is a 56 Ford.
Huh. I'm impressed that you know that.
Oh, I had one that was black and salmon colored. Back in the days when they had two-tone cars, 56 Ford. My father lent me the money to buy it. It was used. It was... At the end of my freshman year in college.
So that was your car?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I loved
you were a
car.
Sharp guy.
Oh, it didn't even...
I mean, you still are a sharp guy. But yeah, you don't drive a car like that anymore.
Well, I rented it into the ground. It was used... But it was a really nice car.
I can tell this is going to be a rambling, interesting day. We're starting off on a good foot.
It makes my heart feel good.
Talking about... what did you say it was? It
makes my heart feel good. A Ford. 56 Ford.
Okay. That's a handsome car.
Yeah.
Was it that color?
No. Mine was black and salmon.
Whoa!
And it was interesting.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to park it in front of our house or on the street where we lived. Truly.
Your dad laid down the law? Or your mom?
My dad. My mom was already deceased. My mom wouldn't have cared.
Too flashy for your dad.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So.
Okay, so.
Do you have any other dates you'd like to give our listeners, if there's any of them left?
Oh, yeah. But that's coming up next month. March 10th, Charlotte Blake Alston will be at the Speak Story Series.
Yay.
At Reynolds Hall, 7:30 on Tuesday night, March 10th. And I'm really looking forward to that. And I'll tell all the dates later.
Okay.
So you should start us off with a story.
Okay. It's a little kind of, it's about the usual length of my stories. It's not real long. Okay. So, Stosh, you know that I tell some well-documented historical narratives about my very diverse ancestors, all the way from my father's enslaved African-American grandfather, so my great-great-grandfather, my dad's great grandfather, to my mother's Jewish Mason great-great-uncles back in England, and then the Austrian and Polish Jewish immigrants who came to the U.S. through Ellis Island and wound up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and eventually settled in New York City. Well, this is a very different kind of ancestor story. So my dad was a true raconteur, and there was a whole category of stories in his repertoire that he called shaggy dog stories, stories that have no purpose except laughter and maybe a bit of wonder. So this is one of those stories. Back in the days of sailing ships, before there were steam-powered engines, you could cross the Atlantic Ocean under huge white sails on ships powered by strong ocean winds pushing against white canvas. There were mermaids in those days. Beautiful women who lived in the sea with tails like a fish instead of legs. And they would swim up to a sailing ship to listen to the sailors talking. If they heard the name of a thing or of a person, the mermaid would call out for that thing or person by name. And these mermaids were not like those silly young girl mermaids that you see in your moving pictures these days, always teary-eyed and getting in trouble on land. These mermaids had their own special power. If they called for a thing, you had to give it to them. If you didn't, you'd be in deep trouble. The mermaids could capsize a ship right then and there, turn it upside down. Plenty of men died, drowned from ships overturned and sunk by angry mermaids back in those days. Well, after a while, the ship captains learned to change all the men's names to objects that they had on the ship. So this man might be called Hammer, and that one might be Water Barrel. Another one could be Axe. If the captain or the first mate wanted a man to do something, he'd holler out the made-up name. You there, Mr. Hammer, climb the rigging and check the mainsail. Now, an eavesdropping mermaid might call for the rigging, the ropes that supported the sails, or the mainsail, the biggest canvas on the ship. But it was likely the mermaid would call out instead, give me that Mr. Hammer! So the captain made sure there were plenty of spare ropes, canvases, and spare hammers on board to throw to the mermaids when they called for them by name. As long as you had extra hammers, you didn't need to throw Mr. Hammer overboard. And that worked pretty well. A lot of sailors' lives were spared by using those made-up names. There was a certain ship's captain. Let's call him Captain Seaweed. Captain Seaweed was a white man, but the ship's carpenter on that ship was a dark-skinned man born in Africa. The ship's carpenter was the man responsible for maintaining and repairing the ship's wooden hull and deck, the sailing masts, and the yards, the wooden spars, the bars attached to the tall wooden masts to hold the huge white canvas sails that caught the wind that powered the ship. The carpenter was responsible for all the wood on a wooden sailing ship, an important job out there in the middle of the salt, salt sea. The carpenter reporting to Captain Seaweed was called Sam. That was not the name he was born with, but he had worked as a sailor since he was a small boy, sometimes on ships owned and worked by Africans, sometimes by white men. Most people called him Sam. Now, Captain Seaweed had a lot on his mind. He did not always remember that mermaid safety rule I mentioned earlier, remembering to change the names of the sailors to objects they had on the ship. One day, Captain Seaweed forgot and shouted out, "You, Sam, go below deck and check those barrels you repaired. Make sure they aren't leaking." Right away, a mermaid calls out from the sea alongside the ship, "Give me that, Sam!" Well, they didn't have any tools or other things on board named Sam, only the man himself. Captain Seaweed did not want to throw Sam to the mermaid, but could think of no alternative. He couldn't risk refusing that mermaid and possibly causing the drowning of all the men on board, himself included. He did apologize to poor Sam as he had three other sailors throw Sam over the side of the ship to the mermaid. Well, as soon as Sam hit the water, the mermaid grabbed him. This particular mermaid had beautiful, long, dark, luxurious, curly hair. So thick, long, and curly that she could wrap Sam up completely covered in her hair. She did it so well and so fast, he didn't even get wet. She swam so fast, they arrived at her home on the bottom of the ocean before Sam had a chance to draw a breath. When they reached her home, she pulled him into her house, unwrapped her hair from all around him, looked him up and down, and said, "I guess you'll do. Do you like fish?" Now, Sam was not born yesterday. He answered right off, "No, not for eating. I wouldn't even cook a fish." And the mermaid said, "All right, then. We'll marry right away." And so they did. The mermaid's house was a fine house built right into the wall of the sea, the same way an alligator builds his house, digging out long rooms, not very high, but 20 feet long or more. Now, unlike the alligator's house, the mermaid's house was full of beautiful carved dark wood furniture imported from all over the world. Sam did like that house. He liked living there just fine. He did not like the food. Of course, he wouldn't eat fish out of respect for his fishtail wife. So he concentrated on the seaweed, sea kelp, other sea plants. These foods did not quite agree with Sam. Too salty from the ocean water. From Sam's point of view, the food in the mermaid's house left much to be desired, but otherwise Sam was content there. He did not leave the house much, but whenever he did, he was quickly surrounded by mermaids, and not just two or three. Sam was a handsome man, and there were not many men about at the bottom of the ocean, so many mermaids stopped to chat with him. One mermaid in particular, a friend of Sam's mermaid wife, began to drop by their house to say, "Hello, Sam," whenever she was in the neighborhood. Sam's mermaid wife was not pleased with all the attention Sam was getting from her flirty friend. Sam's wife was not a shy person. She immediately confronted her now ex-friend and, tossing back her long, dark, thick, luxurious, curly hair, told her to stay away, never come back here, and most important, stay away from Sam. The flirty friend was a little afraid of Sam's wife, so she did stay away. But she was only waiting for an opportunity. She had already decided if she couldn't have Sam for herself, no one would. Now, back in those days, there was a Valentine's Day custom among the mare folk, mare maids, mare women, and mare men alike. Any human married to a mermaid or a mereman was fair game on Valentine's Day. If a human being married to a mereman or a merewoman was caught alone by another mereman or merewoman on Valentine's Day, the finder might do as she liked, or he might like, with the human being. Somehow, no one had bothered to tell Sam this custom. And the first Valentine's Day after Sam's marriage, the flirty friend lured Sam outside with two pork chops she had gotten from a human woman who lived all alone on an island with her many pigs, traded some big, beautiful seashells for those pork chops. Once Sam came out of his wife's house, the flirty friend said, "Don't you miss your home? Wouldn't you like to eat pork chops more often? Don't you want to see your friends and all you left behind on land?" Sam had to admit he did. And that mermaid wrapped him up in her hair, swam fast to the edge of the sea, pushed him up on the land, and waved goodbye. With a great flap of her green-scaled fishtail, she sank beneath the sea. It took Sam some time to get his bearings and find his way home again to the place he lived before he first went to sea. But after that, he gave up the sailing life and became a land carpenter and a wood carver. He'd sit in front of his little house by the sea, carving beautiful wooden mermaids out of old driftwood and big, larger-than-life mermaids from old mahogany and ebony tree trunks. That was a long, long time ago. But my dad used to say, Sam became a very rich man. He never married again, people said. But people said folks came from miles and miles away to buy his wooden mermaids, maybe to sit on a parlor table just for company or to decorate the prow of a new ship. And every one of Sam's wooden mermaids was carved with long, dark, thick, luxurious, curly hair. What was that sound?
That was, and I like this story. I just have, there are some things I wanted to know about.
Okay, questions.
When Sam was back on land, was he on that island?
No.
No. She just
not on the pork chop island. She took him.
Okay. I missed that. Why'd she put him on land?
Because she couldn't have him. She was afraid of the other mermaid.
Okay, that makes sense.
Well, I guess I need to clarify.
It's okay. Mermaid stories always fascinate me.
Because?
Well, because when I was young, I didn't care. I just thought it was, I always thought it was really dumb.
As a young boy,
it's like, you know, there can't be women swimming in the ocean that are, you know, with their there are fish from their waist down and stuff like that. But in reading a lot about mermaids in different cultures, it seems like every culture that has stories about a mermaid. Taking off their skin.
That's a silky.
Yeah, I know, but they're mermaids. It's the same kind of thing. You know. And they have legs under their skin. You know,
yeah,
take
so
off
that's,
their skin.
That's different.
I know.
That's
but
very
they,
different.
They made more sense to me than, you know.
Because there was a suit.
Well,
like a super
because
suit.
They had legs, you know. And the fish part always just really bothered me. Until I was old enough to know where the mermaid thing came from with the sailors.
And that made all the difference.
Yeah, because then it made sense. Okay, they just imagined those creatures swimming with the tail and being lonely sailors. They like to imagine all kind of things. And so looking at something like a manatee or maybe a walrus, they would see a creature with a tail and imagine the part that they wanted to see, a beautiful face and stuff. Because certainly no one's ever seen a mermaid.
And stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
yes. That's one of my favorite words. The world is made of stuff.
Even mermaids.
Everything. Stuff takes the place of atoms.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Those questions.
It.
Did you have any other questions?
Did you ever see Splash?
Oh, yes.
That was a very romantic story.
Yeah, it's not my favorite because it wasn't. It was never my image of a mermaid. It didn't compute. It was entertaining.
It was
and a little sad.
Very entertaining. I liked looking at Daryl Hannah.
I always liked Daryl Hannah, I do have to say. But it wasn't. I like this mermaid story.
Yeah.
Much better.
Well,
because the mermaids have their own world and their own point of view. They are not pining away for land-based mammals.
I know. My brain just doesn't accept them well. When the silkies come up on land, take off the skin, and they can breathe.
That makes sense to you.
Makes sense. But to take a sailor off a boat, drive down to the bottom of the sea in a mermaid house, where does the mermaid get the machines that make oxygen for him to breathe?
It's all magical.
I know.
It's all about love.
Right. It is.
Love. Love.
Very weird.
Okay. Do you have anything, any announcements you want to make, or shall I make some announcements?
You make some announcements.
Okay.
You're not going to tell us.
No, I'm not going to give you the roster for Stories in the Round. Not yet. You're just going to have to be a little more patient for a little while longer.
Oh, yeah. Patience is one of my fortitudes.
Okay. So this is February 10th. February, I forgot the date. February 16th, I will be doing a service at the Unitarian Church on telling a whole bunch of very short stories to illustrate some ethical principles. It is a church, after all. I'm sorry about that. but it's going to be fun. They will be funny stories, most of them. And everybody's invited. But if you want more information, you can call me at 301-730-1638. Right. On March 14th, there is a women's festival, the first ever, as far as I know, women's storytelling festival at Alchabeen and Town Hall in Fairfax, Virginia, on Chainbridge Road. And you can just Google Fairfax, City of Fairfax Women's Storytelling Festival, and get a whole lot more information. There are so many nationally renowned storytellers coming, and a whole lot of local regional tellers as well. I will be telling there on twice on Saturday, and a whole bunch of my good friends are going to be there, as well as some people that I would like to be my friends, but I don't really know them well enough yet, like Donna Washington. And
this is a three-day event?
Well, it's a two-day event. It's Friday evening and Saturday. There are some things going on Sunday, but those are by invitation only. But you should get your tickets quick, because it is possible that this festival will sell out. Alchabeen is not a very large venue. I have not been to the town hall, so I'm not sure about that one. But I'm guessing it's not going to hold hundreds and hundreds of people, and I'm thinking that's who's going to be there. I'm really looking forward to this. And Jessica Piscatelli-Robinson, who's coordinating the festival, has done an excellent job pulling everybody together, organizing things. She has an exquisite lineup of tellers, myself excluded. but I will have a good time listening to everybody else. And I may even have a good time myself up on stage. You never know.
Do you know what you're telling?
Pretty much. But I'm not going to tell you.
Have I ever heard pretty much?
You've heard one of them. It won't be called pretty much, but...
I thought that might be the title.
Okay, and then in April, I think there's something else in March too, but it slipped my mind. But on April 4th, which I think is a Saturday, I will be sponsoring, coordinating a dinner tell with seven tellers, yourself amongst them, Mr. Zilkowski.
All right.
And it's going to be fun. There will be tons of food.
Where will this be held?
This will be held at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown, 13245 Searfoss.
And I know how to get there.
You do. And that's 11:30 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, because we're calling it a dinner tell, a midday dinner. So we'll have that's tons of food.
A Saturday.
That's a Saturday. Mm. A Saturday midday dinner.
April 4th.
April 4th.
Easy to remember. 4-4.
There you go. Okay. That's helpful. And any other information you want about any of those dates, call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638, or email me at Fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. That's my story.
And we just got a phone call. Somebody wants to know what's happening in March with Stories in the Round.
There will be an event in March. It won't be on the fourth Monday of the month, I don't believe, but it is happening. But I can't tell you who it is. Ostash says it's the fourth Monday. Well, he's usually right about numbers, so we can go with that. But again, call me, 301-730-1638. I'm not going to announce the March teller because it could change. You never know.
Might.
Okay.
Might.
It's your turn.
My turn.
To ramble on now.
What I want to do, and since it's up to us what we do on the show, I'm going to read a poem.
Okay.
Okay. And I'm hoping it'll make sense to people. This poem was written about a dozen years ago, maybe more. Let's see, a dozen from 2008, about 2008 or 2009.
By yourself?
By myself.
Okay.
With no help from anyone else. Actually, I have no idea if it was, it was just me. I was the one holding the pencil. And I wrote this because I was involved in an event where we did love letters with one of the...
The play love letters.
Play love letters with a dear friend named Jackie, and was a member of my theatrical group in Arkansas. And she has taken over the theater since I left there. And they're doing wonderful. They're doing a dinner theater coming up next month, which I would love to go to. But it's a little bit expensive to go out to Arkansas just for an evening and having a dinner theater. Anyway, this is a poem that I wrote in honor of Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning. If you know anything about Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, maybe this poem will make sense. And if you don't, maybe it'll make sense anyway. Two lives begun 6 years apart, and lessons learned in similar ways. Formal school not suitable for him, and forbidden to her. Those times were so dim. Loved and cherished by parents, free to explore with open minds, the world exciting and made so near by writings and books of many kinds. Both learned in speech, spoke many tongues, gained knowledge gleaned from foreign lands. Each wrote wise words from an early age, preparing to enter the worldly stage. His stature was less, but it mattered not, for praise from others meant little compared to the notice of the only one who was more than hope could possess. Writing to tell how her words do please, words she has written mean so much more than others that seem hollow and miss what simply is true as never before. Perhaps an exchange of letters could be a sharing of thoughts, words penned by each, and minds so alike in poetry and praise may join in friendship in future days. And thus it began, a meeting arranged by a mutual admirer to both a dear friend. The vigorous young man who admired from afar met the invalid woman, already a star. Weak and sheltered, protected by love of parent and siblings who held her so dear. She met her admirer and over some time gained strength and resolved to conquer her fear. The courtship, forbidden to end as it would, caused father to speak to her never again. But the love they shared grew each day. They became truly one and soon were away to a land where her health was better restored, a warm sunny clime with the one she adored. They lived in joy and fame came to both. Their world of love soon blessed with a son, and friends did admire even works from the past, especially the sonnet written for one. Her illness returned and finally did claim her, and in his arms she rested her last. Her final word, as she gazed at her love, spoke volumes of how life now, as she passed. "Beautiful," she said. And now I ended this with a performance of her famous sonnet, 43. There were words written for him, her love so dear. But I'm not going to read this sonnet today. I read that last week.
Okay, so anybody can go to our podcast at talltales.enlightenradio.org. Right.
Possibly the most, one of the most recognizable lines ever written in the English language, used so many times in wedding ceremonies and engagements and things like that. "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways." And that was written by Elizabeth Barrett Browning.
I love both those poems.
Thank you.
And yours was very interesting. I don't know that I've ever heard it before.
This one?
Mm-hmm.
I've never told anyone that outside of Arkansas.
Wow.
We did a performance of Love Letters right around Valentine's Day. And Love Letters is a short play. And what we did was we wanted the audience to have an experience like regular theater. Love Letters is a short play, so if you go to the theater to see it, and it's done many places all over the country, especially around Valentine's Day, it lasts a little over an hour and has a very short intermission. So we wanted to do a little bit more. And so I read this poem, and then Jackie told the sonnet 43 without notes. Of course, she was younger than I am. And did a beautiful job of that. And then we did Love Letters. And the audience really liked it. And I think it was a good setup for the show Love Letters, which you know well because you've done it.
I have.
Right. You were.
Only because I know you.
Right. And you did a wonderful, you did a wonderful job. I've done it with many other women.
And,
really.
I'm shocked.
Yes. Never able to convince my wife to do it because she doesn't like to perform on stage. So
that is her prerogative. She has performed on stage a lot as a musician.
Yes, and in a couple of shows.
I'm sorry I missed them.
The shows?
That would have been fun. Both the music and the shows.
25 years ago, you could have seen us both on stage. You have never seen me on stage when I lived in Frederick. You never bothered to come and watch it.
No, I never did. If I had known you, I might have.
You might have. Yeah.
Okay, I have another story that I'm working on, unless you have another story that is ready to go.
The thing I was going to talk a little bit more about the Barrett.
Oh, good.
I managed to get a copy of the first 6 months of the love letters that they wrote to each other. In the poem, I mentioned that there's a line in the poem that says that he wrote. Let's see, what is it? Anyway, he wrote her a letter to begin with. Because he admired her writing. She was an established and published poet at the age of 15. And she was well known in England and in America. This was in the early 1800s. And her writing was well known. And Robert Browning was not as well known. And he had written poetry and was published, and she remarked about his writing, about his poem that he wrote, to a friend, a mutual friend of theirs. And he was so pleased by that he decided to write to her and thank her. And so by doing that, they started in less than 2 years. So sometimes the books say about 20 months of writing back and forth to each other, 574 letters they exchanged. And this week I was able to get a copy of those letters. Actually, I have two copies now, one on my computer and a copy I got from the library. And I thought I would share with our audience. Imagine the guts of someone to write to an established poet. And this is the first, the first letter written by Robert Browning to Elizabeth Barrett. Do you mind if I read this?
Oh, I think you should.
Okay. I love your verses with all my heart, dear Miss Barrett, and this is no offhand complimentary letter that I shall write. Whatever else, no prompt, matter of course, recognition of your genius, and there a graceful and natural end of the thing. Since the day last week when I first read your poems, I quite laughed to remember how I have been turning and turning again in my mind what I should be able to tell you of their effect upon me. For in the first flush of delight, I thought I would this once get out of my habit of purely passive enjoyment, when I do really enjoy, and thoroughly justify my admiration, perhaps even as a loyal fellow craftsman should, try and find fault and do you some little good to be proud of hereafter. But nothing came of it at all. So into me has it gone, and part of me has it become, this great living poetry of yours, not a flower of which, but took root and grew. Oh, how different that is from lying to be tried and pressed flat and prized highly and put in a book with a proper account at top and bottom and shut up and put away, and the book called a flora. After all, I need not give up the thought of doing that too in time, because even now, talking with whoever is worthy, I can give a reason for my faith in one and another excellence. The fresh, strange music, the affluent language, the exquisite pathos, and true, new, brave thought. But in this addressing myself to you, your own self, and for the first time, my feeling arises altogether. I do, as I say, love these books with all my heart, and I love you too. Do you know, I was once not very far from really seeing you. Mr. Kenyon said to me one morning, would you like to see Miss Barrett? And then he went to announce me. But then he returned, you are too unwell. And now it is years ago, and I feel as at some untoward passage in my travels, as if I had been close, so close to some world's wonder in chapel or crypt. Only a screen to push, and I might have entered, but there was some slight, so it now seems, slight and just sufficient bar to admission, and the half-open door shut. And I went home my thousands of miles, and the sight was never to be. Well, these poems were to be, and this true, thankful joy and pride with which I feel myself. Yours ever faithfully, Robert Browning. I just think that is incredible, because Elizabeth Barrett was not well from the age of about 15. She had a terrible accident with a horse. In trying to get her horse ready to ride, she insisted on putting the saddle on the horse herself. The horse moved, the saddle fell on top of her, and she injured her back. And along with that, she had weak lungs. And so from early in her life, she was using morphine, prescribed by the doctors for the pain. Her lungs were very poor. She had a hard time with breathing. And so for about 5 years before Browning actually met Elizabeth Barrett, she was in her bedroom. She seldom left her bedroom. She lived with her parents, with her father, who loved her dearly, a very strict curmudgeon type. And so she really was bedridden. And she seldom saw visitors. But John Kenyon was a man, an older man, who was an acquaintance of the family. And it turned out that he was also an acquaintance of the Brownings. And so he finally arranged a meeting, and which came after after Browning had written her this letter. And what began was a little bit less than 2 years of correspondence back and forth. And the writing is just absolutely marvelous. And of course, it's kind of dated, you know, from the 1800s. But I just admire the boldness of the man to write to her and say, I love your poems, I love your writing, and I love you too. And he hadn't ever actually seen her. And he was 6 years younger than she was. So, and that began one of the great love stories of all time. I think that their love story is, in my mind, one of the best love stories ever. And when they did get married, they were together for 15 years. They moved to Italy. When he proposed to her and finally convinced her to marry him, and it didn't, it wasn't a difficult convincing, she actually snuck out of the house while her father was away, and they went and were married, and then he brought her back to the house, and she stayed there for another week. No one knew about their wedding, and then shortly after that, he made arrangements to go and get her and take her to Italy, where the climate was much better, and actually her health improved greatly. Her health improved so much that 3 years after they were married, they had a son, and then she stayed alive for another 12 years. They were married for 15 years, and in 1861, she died in his arms. And there is a sad postscript, in a way. I'm not very sentimental about burials, but there's an interesting thing. She was buried in a beautiful Italian area in an English cemetery. And her sarcophagus is magnificent. It's just wonderful. And Browning lived another 28 years. And when he died, he could not be buried in the same place, because 16 years after Elizabeth died, the Italian government closed that cemetery to any more burials. So Robert Browning is buried in Westminster Abbey in the Poet's Corner, which is a big honor in England. And there is only one woman poet named in that place, and it is on his tombstone. His dates are on the tombstone, and then it says, his wife, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, lies in, and names the place where she's buried, which I think is just wonderful. So,
so I have a question.
Yes.
Well, I'll start by asking, did her father predecease her?
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, the day he found out she had married, he disowned her and never spoke to her again.
I thought you were going to say he died soon after she left.
No. Well, it turns out that there is a very interesting thing about her father. Her father was wealthy when she was young. Money from sugar plantation from his family. But when she was about 20, her mother became ill. And he had lost most of his fortune. But he went to the banks and borrowed a great deal of money, which he was never able to repay, to hold on to the place that they lived. It was in a place in England called Hope End. And they lived together in that place for two more years until his wife died. And he did that because he wanted his wife to be able to live in their beautiful estate. It's like 20 bedrooms and a really fancy place. They left there after she died and moved to Wimpole Street. And there are movies in the old days, in the 30s, 40s, I'm thinking of 50s, of the Barretts of Wimpole Street. They're famous historical movies. The problem with her father was he forbid all 12 of his children to marry. Three daughters and 9 sons. There's all kind of speculation about why he did that. But there is some evidence that he did that because his family had lived in Jamaica and on the sugar plantations, his father and grandfather, I believe. And he was sort of convinced or worried that there was some intermarriage between some of the blacks on the island and his family. And he thought it would be disgraceful if any of his children were to be married, and it turned out that I don't even know if he knew anything about genetics. I kind of doubt it. But he knew enough to know that when people conceive a child, if they're black, the child should be black. And if they're one of the parents is black and one is white, the child may also be black. And he would have been disgraced by that. So that's why he forbid his children to marry. However, 3 of his children went against his wishes and did marry. And she was one of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
I know. It would make a good... I think they should make a modern version of their
story. Were those speculations in any of the films?
No, not that I know of. I haven't seen the films. They were a long time ago, though I was alive when the last ones were made. There was also some other kind of rumors that possibly he didn't want her to marry. She was the oldest, and he was extremely fond of her, and spent lots of time together. But there was some speculation that possibly he was in love with her and that she was kept close because it was more than just an admiration. There's never been anything proved about that, and she never, ever said anything about it. But in one of the movies, Charles Laughton played her father, and I did some research and found out that Charles Laughton, the actor, purposely in at least one scene made it obvious by the way he admired his daughter and watched her and looked at her, that his interest was more than fatherly.
Hmm.
That was a choice that the actor made, according to research. But perhaps he knew he thought he knew something no one else did. But anyway, I think this is a great love story.
It is a wonderful love story.
And it really appeals to my Catholic background for them to sneak off against the father's wishes. And another reason that the father was not enamored of Browning was that Elizabeth was famous, very well known and admired. And Robert Browning was not that famous yet. It turned out at the end of his life, he was extremely famous. He reached great heights in that. And another wonderful thing about the times, Wadsworth, the great poet, was the poet laureate in England. And he was succeeded by Tennyson. However, Elizabeth Barrett was considered when after Wadsworth, she was considered as one of the leading people to become the poet laureate. But it didn't happen. It went to Tennyson, and I'm sure at those times a woman would have had to have more than just a great reputation in order to get some position like that.
Well, I had heard bits and pieces of these stories that you're telling, but I had never heard such a comprehensive telling of their lives together. Very interesting.
I'm thinking I'm going to tell that at the
Oh, I think you should.
Tomorrow.
It's really, really good.
Well, it's easy to do here.
On the radio?
On the radio, sure. There are no faces looking at me and saying, what? What do you say? And no one's sleeping, you know. And you're a great audience, so.
Well, it's not going to be a huge audience, so I think
I'm going to tell it. I'm going to tell the story, and then I am going to finish it with the poem that she wrote for her husband.
And this is going to be fun.
Yeah, and that was 43. There were 44 sonnets in the book she published, Sonnets from the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
And I have wondered that for many years. Why did they call it Sonnets from the Portuguese? And it turns out from my research that Robert Browning called Elizabeth, his pet nickname for her was My Little Portuguese. I couldn't find out exactly why he did that, but that's what his nickname for her was. And so Sonnets from the Portuguese makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I had never heard the explanation. Okay. It's time for us to leave.
I know.
I will take us out, if that's okay.
This is scary.
This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stasi Okowski.
Your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, independent community radio, broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm closing out this week's show. We hope you go to tales.enlightenradio.org and listen to some of our podcasts, either today's, if you missed pieces, or any other week. The Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.